Ray Rankin, the authors of the book, How We Fight White Supremacy, A Field Guide to Black Resistance. But first, this from KABU. KABU Community Radio is hiring a news and public affairs director to manage the evening news and public affairs programming and to train and supervise volunteers. For this full-time position, we're looking for someone with proven experience in news and public affairs production, management and supervisory skills with volunteers with an emphasis on teamwork in a collaborative setting, and ability to work under strict deadlines. KABU Community Radio is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. People of color and women are encouraged to apply. The deadline to apply is Monday, July 1st at midnight. More information can be found at kabu.fm/employment.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Patrick Kimmons Birthday Remembrance on Monday, June 17th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Southwest 4th Avenue and Harvey Milk Street in Portland. Patrick Kimmons was born on June 17th, 1991. This will be his birthday remembrance and protest of his murder by Portland police on September 30th, 2018. This event will have food, water, soda, coffee, candles, and opportunities to share memories of Patrick and organize against police violence. Again, that's Patrick Kimmons' birthday remembrance on Monday, June 17th, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Southwest 4th Avenue and Harvey Milk Street in Portland. More information is available at kabu.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on your community radio station, KBOO, 90.7 in Portland, 91.9 in Hood River, 104.3 in Corvallis, KBOO.fm via the World Wide Web. And I am Cecil Prescott, and today is Monday, June 10th, 2019. And we are so pleased to have you joining us this morning. This morning we will speak with the authors of an anthology and a how-to manual, maybe even something to encourage and inspire us all. How We Fight White Supremacy, A Field Guide to Black Resistance. Joining us this morning will be the collaborators of this volume. And they are with us. They will be with us very, very soon. Let me just say something about the book. I came across this great review on Amazon, which I think is so so appropriate, and this appropriate, and it's a verified purchase, so obviously someone actually bought the book and read it, said, "Reading this book is like escaping from the linen cloth dinners of academia and going with your auntie after church to get a fried whiting sandwich on white bread with some hot sauce. Just hot and fresh and soothing in a visceral way. As a professor, I'm so accustomed to reading academic works from a distance, but this book pulled me in like a lover's embrace." And what a wonderful way of describing this volume. So often we have the opportunity to speak with authors over a variety of topics. And one thing that is encouraging or inspiring or soothing about this book, it is more than an academic exercise, the collaboration, the writers from a variety of fields and experiences and genders and expressions, and they all affirm how we continue to resist white supremacy. And let me give you a number so you may join with our conversation in a few minutes. Our studio number here are 503-231-8187. And joining us is Akiba Solomon. Good morning, and thank you for joining us today.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Hey, thank you for, you know, this volume and for inspiring us in so many ways. And I thought we might begin by asking about the title of the volume, How We Fight White Supremacy. Now, you know, in recent since number 45 is in there, there's been a rise, at least in people's recognitions of white supremacy. How did you why did you choose to name this volume this?
I mean, so first of all, we actually came up with the idea before 45 was elected.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's definitely timely for now, but just always want to make that distinction so that we can let people know that, you know, white supremacy clearly didn't start with 45.
Yes.
Although manifestations of it appear to be happening more and also are getting more coverage. But we chose this title because we actually don't know how to stop white supremacy, which is why we say how we fight white supremacy, because the idea is to catalog the different ways in which we resist a system. And it's a system that we identify as a political, cultural, economic, and a political, culture, and economic system that subjugates people who are not white. And so we thought the most direct way to get at this idea of sort of cataloging these methods was to just call it what it's called, How We Fight White Supremacy, A Field Guide to Black Resistance.
Excellent. And I understand that Kenria has joined us. Good morning. How are you this morning?
Good morning. I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let me ask you, because it's such a collection, as your collaborator Akiba shared, in terms of voices and ways in which people struggle against white supremacy. How did you maybe begin to not only collaborate but sort through all these voices and ways in which people resist white supremacy?
Sure. So for us, it was really key that we have that diversity of voices. But we really started with something super simple, which was an outline.
So,
we knew from the beginning that we would have 10 chapters, and we knew what we wanted each of those chapters to cover in terms of themes. So, you know, we have chapters like Love Me or Leave Me Alone, which talks about the ways that we as black people love ourselves whole. We have chapters like I'm Not One of Your Little Friends, which talks about youth organizing and youth organizers. And so because we had those 10 buckets, we were able to then say, okay, who are some people who we know who are working in these fields that make sense with these individual themes? And then we also, because we wanted to cover people who are both sung and unsung,
Yes. We
use our journalistic skills. Right? We put on our reporter hats and started researching and looking for people who were doing work at the local level who everyone may not know, but who are really doing something to move the needle.
That is so important and so encouraging for all of us, because I think on occasion we might have heard or read some of the people that you share in this volume, but the fact that you lift up and and honor the voices of people both locally and nationally, I think is so important. And as I think Akiba mentioned, in terms of how we fight white supremacy, it's mm-hmm. it's people doing it in many different ways. And so I think it's important. And thank you for bringing these different voices all together.
Thanks. Thank you. Yeah, it was really important for us, as Tenria said, to do the sung and the unsung, because we know any fight against white supremacy has to be multi-pronged. And also, you know, what we want to talk about is diversity. So not everybody is the best public speaker in the world. Not everybody is a professional organizer. And again, you know, not everybody has the lived experience of being previously incarcerated. And so we just wanted to make sure that we covered a lot of different bases and that we didn't privilege public activism, although we definitely highlighted, we didn't want to make that seem like the only way to fight white supremacy, because it certainly isn't.
Yes. You are listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO, and we are speaking with the editors of How We Fight White Supremacy, A Field Guide to Black Resistance, Akiba Solomon and Kenya Rankin, and they pulled together all these voices to share, to acknowledge, to celebrate, to inspire all of us in terms of, and recognize all of us as we continue to resist white supremacy. If you like to comment or share your thoughts with them, please give us a call here at 503-231-8187. We'll take your calls and have them share their thoughts with you and engage in a mutual conversation. One thing that occurred to me, and I think I would like Akiba to address this in terms of recognizing the variety of ways in which we struggle, is for me at least, you was a term that I was unfamiliar with that you talk about and that's emotional justice. There is so much that's going on that impact all of us in many ways. So I thank you for uplifting that. And what is emotional justice in this field of struggling against white supremacy?
Sure. I mean, first I want to give credit to the person who, as far as I know, coined the phrase emotional justice. That is Esther Arma, who's not in the book, who is a Ghana-based activist, playwright, and journalist. And so the idea of, you know, emotional justice is just that, you know, one of the main vestiges of white supremacy is that it harms people psychologically. It forms the way people think about themselves and think about other people. It forms how people behave. It forms, you know, what people are subjected to. And so there's really no way to talk about white supremacy without talking about the mental and emotional toll that it takes on people. And this is also why we were very careful to include the voices of therapists, because we know, I mean, and studies are beginning to show that, for instance, racism will shorten the life of a person of color who suffered. And you know, very much so. It's a combination, yes, of, you know, poor health care or, you know, less money to buy nutritious food or whatever else, but it's also about the stress that it brings on people. And so, you know, we recognize that there's no way that you can experience white supremacy, whether it's overt or covert, without knowing that it has some toll on your emotional life.
Yes, and I was reading a social media post from a friend of mine, and she was writing about this type of trauma and resistance, and the need to acknowledge that, and the need to find ways in which we take care of ourselves. and to encourage and support one another. Certainly, in this struggle against white supremacy, it's ongoing and it isn't easy. And also, what you acknowledge for us is the role of not this struggle, but somehow the how we struggle. I'm thinking particularly in terms of how we resist. So in terms of like love and humor and I don't know. I saw an interview with you when you mentioned talking about double dutch. what are ways in which we resist, which celebrates our cultures?
Mm-hmm. Kenria, you want to grab this?
Sure. So, like you said, we really do focus on the things that aren't what everyone typically thinks of when it comes to resistance, which I think very often it conjures up images of people on, you know, picket lines and holding protest signs. And that's what we see on TV, and that's the way that it's often portrayed. But everybody's not that person. Everyone doesn't have the privilege of being able to put themselves on the line in that way. So, you know, we have an entire chapter on laughter as resistance, which is called Laugh to Keep from Crying, which talks about the ways that we use sarcasm and shade. And you know, we have a comic where there is a guy who identifies as a punk, and that is where his activism is rooted. And the comic is about black activists like going after Nazis. And it's just, you know, we really dive into the ways that we do it that aren't just the ones that we think of. We also, like you said, we talk a lot about love, and that manifests in a lot of different ways within the book and just within, you know, people's resistance in general. We talk about love for ourselves and how, you know, coming back to that emotional justice piece, how that's not just, you know, I think when people think of self-care, they often think about taking baths and sniffing lavender and that kind of thing, which is something that is key. I don't think I would get through if I didn't have my little lavender with me all the time. But it also looks at, you know, taking the time to dive into the things that you need and doing things for yourself that go beyond the surface, like making great decisions and being careful and intentional about the way that you move through the world. And those things are reflected as self-love as well. We talk about the love that we have for our children and how the ways that we raise them and the tools that we give them is a way of teaching themselves to love themselves in a world that is hostile to them at every turn. We talk about romantic love and the ways that it may or may not be white supremacy, and how we can help to push things further along and to away from white supremacy. So yeah, we really were intentional about bringing joy into this conversation, because I think very often it is left out.
Thank you so much. We're speaking with Kenria Rankin and Akiba Solomon, editors of How We Fight White Supremacy, a Field Guide to Black Resistance. Give us a call if you'd like to share with them, 503-231-8187. It occurred to me that we've been talking for almost 20 minutes about your book, and I don't think we pause to define what we mean by white supremacy. So, what is it? Why is it in the title, centered in your title? Because is it something that means something different to every other person, or what do you mean by white supremacy?
Sure. So Akiba actually touched on it, the definition that we worked with in the book a little earlier, and that is specifically an economic, cultural, and political system that thrives on the subjugation of people who are not white. And the way that we often describe it when we're doing talks is we talk about the fact that there is a hierarchy, and that hierarchy is what white supremacy is built upon, is the scaffolding that it rests on. And that hierarchy places white, cisgender, heterosexual, wealthy, able-bodied Christian men puts them at the very top of the hierarchy, and all the rest of us get slotted down below according to the different pieces of our identity. And that this system, if you are not that person at the top of it, seeks to push you further and further down that hierarchy. And that is essentially how white supremacy works here. And we also talk about it as a smog, this thing that we are all forced to breathe, even if we don't think that we're participating in the system. That if we are intentional and actually want to do resistance work, that we will interrogate our place within the hierarchy and the privilege that we are given based on where we've been slotted within it, and use that privilege in order to secure liberation for all of those who are below us.
Thank you. We have a caller online, and let's go to that caller, and then as we continue. Good morning, caller.
Good morning.
Good morning. It's Camilo again this week. How are you?
Just fine. Welcome.
Good. I want to raise a question of class superiority that really transcends race. And, you know, since we were defining white supremacy, I want to point out that white supremacy is essentially a gimmick that the white power structure uses to keep poor people of different backgrounds from joining together, allowing poor white people to maintain a sense of superiority simply because they're white. And that's what really divides us. And this is a division that operates regardless of education and income. People who are poor are bred in this soup of class superiority. And it's something that they may try to overcome, but even with good education, good jobs, they still retain this sense of identification with this distinction that's made early on. And it goes across class lines. And I think, having come from listening to Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, where Reverend Barber spoke about the kind of unity that's necessary to have an intersectional approach to everybody that's affected by this class supremacy, is really important to recognize. So I think that this should be a consideration in today's discussion about how this overwhelming force continues to operate, even though we like to deny that it happens in this country.
Yeah, this is Akiva. I can comment. You know, that's definitely one read. It's not a read that personally I share. I think classism, of course, is part of perpetuating white supremacy. But when you define a class and people fall under a certain level of class, and race is so integral in defining that, then we're still talking about white supremacy. We're just talking about different modes of it. And so, you know, of course, there needs to be some class unity to a certain extent. But at the same time, you know, everybody has to, number one, agree on their proximity to whiteness. And number two, folks have to, as you said, not fall for the bait, which is, you know, I'm a poor white person, and, you know, the biggest asset that I have is my whiteness. And that's what has happened historically. I mean, if you look at how Irish people became white, quote unquote, or if you look at sometimes now with Latinx people who identify as white, although based on this country's strictures, they would not be. We cannot talk about class until we talk about white supremacy and how class is definitely a part of it.
Also, I'd like to add, Camilo, that while you make some salient points, one of the intents in this book is to offer Black people a place of refuge and contemplation, and they are unapologetically saying that in the beginning of the book, you know, that this is a book about Black people for Black people, and that's it. You know, any
well,
thoughts on
I
that?
I would question that approach, and I think with Reverend Barber that in order to actually have a chance of success, we need to have the populations of different people of color, people who are white, who are poor, people who are gender distinct, to come together in order to form this majority, which he says already exists but needs to be organized.
Well, the beauty of this is that we all get to have our own different approaches, and that the hope is that each of those approaches brings us forward. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Camilo. Mm-hmm. And you're listening to More Talk Radio here on KBOO. I'm Cecil Prescott, and guess who's here?
Yeah, and I am Celeste Carey. And as Cecil had said at the beginning, thank you for, you know, collecting all these voices and weaving them into a harmonious tapestry. I liked how there was room for different ideas about what is and what isn't a way to fight. You know, some people fight by organizing and organizing cross-culturally, and some people fight by just merely being themselves mm-hmm. as authentically as they can. And all of that was pointed out by many of the folks in the book. You know, they say, well, this is how I fight white supremacy. And one thing that was really kind of it was a simple way in which the person fought, but it still had its it still has its gravity. And that was, I think, DJ Blue, Monday Blue, mm-hmm. just by playing the music, just by remembering what we have put in our music and art to sustain us. And I have read countless books by countless older organizers or activists who would talk about their parents playing anything from John Coltrane to Mahalia Jackson, you know, all weekend in the house trying to make sure that their head was right, and also to create some type of enclave so that blackness could be understood and appreciated and reveled in. And so I do really appreciate you collecting this book. But I also want to say it has a lot of younger voices in it. And so I appreciate the fact that these younger organizers are finding ways to deal with the new definitions of white supremacy, the new iterations of white supremacy. And it's not just like you said in your introduction, picket signs, linked arms, and raised fists. It's looking at other ways to attack this hydra.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, because mm-hmm. it's got a whole bunch of heads. You are correct.
And I mean, I think just to touch on what you said about DJ Monday Blue and the music and how people, older activists, have talked about the music that shaped them. I mean, a really important concept for us is cultural retention.
Yes. Yes.
You know, there's a lot, particularly because the way we listen to music now can be quite transient. It can be one song from one person that you add to a mix. There are very few situations where there's an entire album and everybody's listening to it at the same time. And so it becomes important that we don't lose some of the ground that we've covered, and that we don't understand, that we understand where the music comes from, and that's intimately a part of our culture and our history. So, you know, we definitely believe that culture is an important part of this, and music certainly has been one of the molds in which we fight for our freedom.
You know, those words, and reading your book this weekend has meant a lot for me. It's I think it was yesterday was the 116th anniversary of my maternal grandmother's birth.
All right.
And, oh, wow.
And one thing that I got from her was that she was, you know, someone who grew up in segregation. She resisted. She fled to the North and created an environment in first Harlem and then in Queens, New York, where there were a whole bunch of people, you know, artists and musicians and ordinary people and political activists. And there was seems to be such a and people sitting around the kitchen table and eating.
Especially the kitchen table.
And eating.
And eating.
And the thing was that there was such a way in which all these things came together. So it wasn't just like the poet sat over there and the moms struggling, you know, with the children sat on the other side, but there was this collaboration almost of people gathering together, and the importance of the culture in terms of the transformation that is so important that we need to highlight. And so I'm interested in hearing your voices and also Celeste in terms of, you know, in talking about culture and music, how things might change and transform as we highlight ways in which to resist white supremacy.
We do have another caller online. Mike, good morning.
Hello. Yes. I just wanted to say, first of all, that one of the problems with black people dealing with white supremacy is the word people of color. Because every non-white skinned person don't identify with black people. Now, in fact, there are non-whites that are just as racist as white people against black people. So that whole description of people of color is misleading. Second of all, I grew up in segregation, and I know that black people as a race of people was more stronger in their fight to overthrow white supremacy during segregation than they are in this pseudo reality that we live in now, where we think we have integration. And one last thing, one of the reasons why black people can't assimilate is because they spend all of their time giving away their power. You know, it's no accident that during the Vietnam War, the same people that fought against America, they came over here right after the Vietnam War, and most of those people was living in the black community, and now they have assimilated and they're moved on up the ladder. Black people still in the same position. Now, the illegal aliens are coming in here, and black people are fighting on their behalf, and they're moving on up the ladder. They got businesses, they got restaurants, they got everything. Black people ain't got nothing, but yet you're giving away your power. So I think black people have to, first of all, stop giving away your power, man. Quit trying to give other people stuff that it took you forever to fight for. Now you want to give it away. That's one of your problems.
Okay,
let's talk to you later.
Hey, thank you so much, Mike. And let's hear some responses from our authors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, this is Akiva. A lot was said there. So I'm going to actually just choose one part of it. And it's the idea of the illegal alien. Mm. That is terminology that we absolutely do not use.
We say
non-citizens or undocumented folks or migrants. The reason why we do that is because citizenship has always been used as a weapon in American white supremacy, and as we can see now, also European white supremacy and other forms of it. And so, you know, for you to be able to deny someone citizenship based on race and then characterize that person as an illegal it criminalizes people for simply migrating or for simply actually being a person where the United States landed on them, mm-hmm. where they weren't previously, they weren't seeking citizenship in the United States. And the other thing, too, I think the danger with that argument of illegal aliens are stealing our stuff is that it suggests that there are no black people, exactly. and migrants,
Thank
and
you.
Asylum seekers.
Thank you.
You know, people use illegal alien as a euphemism for Latinx people.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I can't go into all of the economic data that show, you know, employment patterns, but I think it's incredibly divisive for us to take issue with Latinx people who are victims of globalization and victims of a particular colonial history and say that that's our problem.
That's right. And the only other thing, this is Kenria, that I'll add to that is, yes, he is correct that anti-blackness exists everywhere. I mean, to give the actual language that's there, right? Yes, there are people who are black who are anti-black. There are people who identify, you know, as with other cultures who are also anti-black. And that goes back to the idea that this is a smog that we breathe in and that folks often participate in it without realizing that they're participating in it. Or you have some people who use it as a way to climb the ladder themselves.
Yes.
And then, you know, we're talking about folks like Ben Carson. We're talking mm-hmm. about folks like our friend on the Supreme Court who mm-hmm. use anti-blackness as a way to aspire to whiteness. They use it as a toehold because they think that in pushing down the folks who look like them, that they can get closer to whiteness. But the reality is that that will never move them there.
No, it wouldn't. Just like they have said that we shouldn't buy the bait regarding the fact that there are poor whites who find themselves in similar situations, we shouldn't buy the bait that there are blacks who are part of the 1% and they made it, and so therefore you can too.
Yeah. Come on now.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, don't buy the hype.
I just want to say one more thing about how we talk about black success or how we talk about black entrepreneurship. You know, black women are starting businesses at the highest rate in this country.
Mm-hmm,
and so when we talk about immigrant groups that come in, quote unquote, to our communities and open businesses, and now they're prospering, I don't think that holds up to actual scrutiny. And I really feel like I understand feeling frustrated. Like, I get it. I feel frustrated a lot. I feel frustrated right now. But it's important for us not to take away what we have achieved. And it's important for us to be really clear about where we actually stand. Segregation is extremely dangerous in terms of economics. There are many ways in which white supremacy manifests itself that keeps black people from advancing. But folks coming from, you know, again, a country that has previously been colonized or a country that we made unlivable through our own interventions and saying that those businesses, that means that entire group of people is you know, more prosperous and that they have it all together, I just think is an oversimplification of what we're actually mm-hmm. seeing.
And ignores the reality and the context that exists, right?
Yes. You are listening Excellent. To More Talk Radio here on your Community Connection, KBOO Portland. We're speaking today with Akiba Solomon and Kenria Rankin on how we fight white supremacy, and this is a field guide to black resistance. We welcome your calls at 503-231-8187, and give us a call, ask a question, make a point, statement, whatever, but share, just share. One of the things that I thought was, it's kind of obvious when you first start writing about the book, but I think it really hit me somewhere in the middle about how much of this is about building community and being community and accepting all the different permutations of blackness and legitimizing it amongst ourselves. I guess one of the things that we try to do as black people is to try to reinforce and I guess pass it forward, the idea that we may come from different tribes or regions in Africa or live in different parts of the country, but we're all still in this same struggle. And I think on a very visceral level, you know, gut level, that many of us still are trying to seek that community that was, and the spirit of the community that was built up in the time of segregation, where it wasn't a monolithic community by any means, but it seemed to be a more focused community. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm.
It does. And it's actually the underpinning of where the idea for this book came from.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to create a community to let folks know, one, that, you know, help them to realize that there may be ways that they're fighting that they don't even realize that they're doing, that they can then be more intentional about, but also that they're not alone.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. That there are so many ways that we're all doing this, and that even if they can't identify something right now, that hopefully by the time that they finish, that they've been inspired by the other folks within this community to figure out the way that they can move forward. And we were super intentional about that. And one of the best things that has happened as we've been, you know, we were on a book tour for about a month and a half and talking to people in different cities, and we would have people come up to the table and say, you know, this one woman in particular say, you know, I work in this rural area. I'm doing birth work. I'm around white people all day. They won't even look me in my eye, and I feel so very alone. Mm-hmm. And this book, she said she had been carrying it with her since she got it, because it reminded her that her work was worthy and that she wasn't out here fighting alone. And that meant everything, because it really reinforced that we had, at least in some part, done what we had set out to accomplish with this work.
Yes.
And the connection comes from so many different rich ways, again, I'm going to say this, of being black. So that it, you know, as I said earlier, it's woven into a tapestry, so we can see all the different ways people relate to being black and relate to each other and create a more unified collective of ourselves so that we can move forward, because racism has morphed, white supremacy has morphed. It uses some of the same tools and principles, but it uses them in different ways. Now we have white supremacists crying out, well, I don't want to be a minority or a quote-unquote refugee in my own country, you know, and that begs a couple of questions, one of them being, you know, your country, you know, but a twisting, a subtle twisting of words and definitions so that it still, it's not just obvious, but it sends, you know, the dog whistle and, you know, communication in quote-unquote polite company. But it's just good to be able to sit up and call it out with folks and to figure out how we're going to address this and to reiterate that the struggle is real. You know, I mean, we heard Reverend Dr. William Barber talking about how he's got to fight state capitals trying to exclude people from constitutionally based protest to concerns about gerrymandering and, mm-hmm. you know, watering down of our forces. We got a caller. Let's go to our caller, Justin. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
We're fine. How are you?
Well, I've been listening since you started. I even listened to the Reverend this morning, and I live over in Tigard, and my wife actually happens to be white, and you know, we go through a lot of racist related incidences here in Oregon. Lots of people stare at us all the time. I just feel uncomfortable out of my body wherever I go. So I completely understand what it is to fight white supremacy in a area that is almost they're nonchalantly racist, because a lot of them, I feel, they support the Democratic side, but they then act in a different way. But I guess my main thing is I was a general manager at a company very young, and I worked my way all the way up, and I worked hard. But it came to a point to where I had these pretty racist owners that tried to manipulate me in every way to control every point of my life, all the way down to my finances. And so when I decided that, you know, enough was enough of giving myself away and being abused and trying to maybe stand up for myself, I guess I would use my blackness, if you will. And we were talking, you guys were talking about the Ben Carsons of the world. And so what I'm trying to get to is, like, does your book kind of talk about how to kind of tone down your blackness or tone down your culture so that you're not, because, you know, I was then fired from that job, and I've been trying to come back up ever since then. And so it's like, how do you regulate your culture in a society with racist people that have control over your future, essentially, and having to rebrand yourself constantly as a young black person because of all of these instances in life that are thrown at us?
So this is Akiba. I mean, it sounds in part like what you're referring to is code switching. And that's not something that we actually take up in the book, although we've had a lot of rich discussion about it during our tour stop.
And could you define code switching for those who may not know?
Oh, sure. Code switching is when you are someone in a dominant culture that is not part of that culture, and that you speak one way to the folks who are in your group and another way to the dominant culture. So that could be anything from, you know, the tone of your voice, how you, a slang you might use.
Taking the bass out of your voice.
Yeah, taking the bass out of your voice. You know, all sorts of, you know, changing your body language and that sort of thing. But one thing, I mean, we've said on our tour about code switching is that we understand that to be a form of resistance and survival. You know, if it were, you know, completely embraced for everybody to run around and talk about white supremacy at work, then that'd be a major coup for us. And we know that doesn't exist. So part of the book is actually, and the book also touches on microaggressions, which come up in the book generally in professional environments. And those microaggressions are daily, mundane abuses, essentially. And part of microaggressions is always, it creates hypervigilance because it makes you wonder if a so-called normal interaction was race-based. And so, you know, we understand the reality of blackness at work. And one thing that we hope to do with this book is to give people a home and give people a place that they can exist and that they can, you know, revel in their blackness, even as they are code switching, or even if they are, even as they do play the game. You know, but I don't think we really, the idea of toning down, I'm not quite sure.
We have one anonymous person who shared the ways that she navigated it at work, and she did it anonymously because she was concerned about retaliation because she was in a corporate America, and she talked about, you know, having to deal with white people asking her about her hair all the time because she changed it, and how she ended up just having a relaxer because it was easier than having than wearing her natural hair and having to answer ask questions about it and things about the way she dressed and sharing things about her life and like having people walk up to her and try to talk about Wu-Tang and like pretending that she didn't know what they were talking about because she didn't want to engage. And so in a lot of ways, the way that she handled it, it wasn't necessarily a toning down. It was subversive in some ways, like pretending she knew who Wu-Tang was. And I guess perhaps her hairstyle could be looked at that. But as we said, we don't think that that's a negative thing. We think that we have to do what we have to do to survive. You got to eat, you know. Mm-hmm. But I think that's probably as directly as we address that in the book. Yeah.
Okay. I definitely read your book. Unfortunately, I don't really think the code switching pertains to me, because even growing up, I mean, I talk the same way that I do now, and I was the one kid in Springfield, Massachusetts growing up, you know, number one dangerous city in the world, in the country in 2005, that everyone would pick on because, oh, why are you so whitewashed? Why do you talk like that? Mm-hmm. And so it's been against my brothers and sisters, my mom had eight kids, I was mainly the one that was different. And I don't know if I adopted that as a kid or what, but I've always struggled with not having enough blackness to the fact to where it still affects me in my life. I don't know.
Well, one thing to consider is how you define blackness. And what your internalized definitions are, because code switching is more than just how you talk. It's about how you shine your light and what kind of lens you might want to use. For example, there are ways in which I have seen people who speak the King and Queen's English throw out little flashes of black consciousness or black presentation, and then pull it back just like a sun lashes mm-hmm. a corona out, you know, a little flicker of light, right. Yeah. And you know, it's their way of keeping their sanity. But as we've said before, being black is not monolithic. It does not mean that you came from the projects or your family is poor or you say you use Ebonics. It's so much more to it than that. It's a way of looking at who you are as a human being, who your family is, and accepting the fact that you have value and worth in this world, you know?
Figure out how to bridge the male, you know, because you guys were talking about the community, how we have such a strong community. We worry about our kids. We sit around the table and we all talk together. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we kind of thrive in that scenario. But when you take us out of that, out of our niche, out of our comfortable spot, how can we then act in that same manner independently with other cultures or with other people? Because they don't understand us is how I perceive it. Like, we have to make them understand us. So I definitely want to read your book, though, and this talk has been super helpful, so I do appreciate that.
Well, thank you, Justin.
Thank you, Justin.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. You're welcome.
So it seems as though you had a little bit more of a thought for follow-up on Justin's comments. Care to elaborate and share?
This is Kenria. I mean, I was just gonna kind of reiterate what you said, that it really depends on his definition. He has to build that home for himself, right?
Like, yes.
For me, that carrying my blackness with me, I don't code switch anymore. But that is just because I've gotten to a point in my career where I don't feel like I have to worry about it affecting my bottom line. But I can remember when I first decided, you know what, I am going to be authentically myself every time. But that is because, to me, my freedom, as I write about actually in the final chapter of the book, which covers freedom dreams, where we, you know, really think about, okay, this is a system that we're in. What do we want to replace it with? To me, that looks like being able to bring my whole self to the table every time. And so I strive to do that. But I don't feel that I am in, that I have to be placed in a role of helping other people to understand what being black means to me.
Yes,
I think that there are some people who are doing wonderful work around that, but Akiba and I are not those folks. Because as you said, you know, and as we write in the intro, we're not a monolith. There are a lot of ways to be black, but also it's not my job to teach you that we dope. Like, I know. My kid knows it. It's my job to teach her that she's dope, but it's not my job to educate you. And there's nothing that I can do that will make you comfortable with black people or make you love black people. You can love black culture all day, right? Like, mm-hmm. We see that every
and
day.
And then hate yourself.
Exactly. That ain't got nothing to do with you loving me and caring about my humanity, thinking I'm human even at the most base level. So to me, that is not work that I am interested in doing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I also, I mean, just to touch on, I think, a core part of what the caller was talking about, I mean, this sort of this disconnect or this idea that the way he speaks or, you know, his mannerisms or whatever, that black people would, you know, tell him that he wasn't black enough, doesn't necessarily square with the question of should we put our blackness to the side when we're at work. I mean, to me, it just shows that no matter what you do, no matter how you sound, no matter who you're married to, there's still a white supremacist undergirding. And in your business and in your life, you could be the person that everybody in your home community said sounded white. That doesn't protect you from racism.
No, it doesn't. No, it doesn't. And we need to remember, I think our younger generations are grasping that. And so, you know, kudos to them and you, because we need that. But there's nothing we can do in and of ourselves or our personality that nullifies racism. You can't talk white. You can't look white. Mm-mm. You can't think white, whatever that is. You know, the bottom line is you have to just be your authentic self, because there's nothing you can do that's going to make them, quote unquote, like you. And, you know, for many people who were told, well, you act too black, or you sound too black, or you dress too black, and that litany that goes on, it's like if you did every one of those things, it still wouldn't matter.
Well, I mean, I've been in workplace situations where I've had white people try to imply that I wasn't black enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So white supremacy is a shapeshifter, right?
Like, yes.
If it says go left and you go left, and they're like, no, actually we meant right. I mean, there's no possible way to keep up with this and remain sane and remain whole in your life.
Well, as somebody said in the book, we have to remember that it's a perversion. You know, it's a perversion of the true natural order of humanity. And and don't try to shape yourself according to a twist.
Because all you're going to end up is with being twisted. That's right.
Twisted. You got me twisted, as they say. So we got just a couple of minutes, words for folks in keeping it together and reading your book.
I don't know. Please read the book.
That sounds good to me.
How we Fight White Supremacy is available everywhere. We encourage folks to go to black booksellers whenever possible to purchase it. As far as keeping ourselves together, I think it's important that we find the joy in this fight and that we live into that community that Celeste was talking about. I mean, it may seem simple, but it is grounding when you are doing work that that can be violent, right? And
yes.
And they can feel hopeless and at sometimes that when you ground yourself in that joy and in that community, it provides space for you to keep going.
Amen. Excellent. Well, thank you so much, Akiba and Kenria. We've just spoken with the authors, or rather the compilers, mm-hmm. of How We Fight White Supremacy, Akiba Solomon and Kenria Rankin. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And coming up is the Omo Variety Hour, followed by Locus Focus, when Barbara Bernstein interviews EPA staffer Betsy Sutherland, who resigned in August 2017, when it became painfully clear that the EPA she had worked for was being gutted by Trump. Stay tuned for these and other things. And join KBOO. If you'd like to become a member, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 50th anniversary of Oxamoxwa with the Garcia Birthday Band on Friday, June 14th at 8 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater in Portland. Oxamoxwa is a 1969 album by the Grateful Dead. Fans and critics alike consider this era to be the band's experimental apex. The Garcia Birthday Band is a group of veteran musicians interpreting and celebrating the repertoire of the late Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead. Again, that's the 50th anniversary of Oxamoxwa with the Garcia Birthday Band on Friday, June 14th at 8 p.m. at the Aladdin Theater, 3017 Southeast Milwaukee Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor Good in the Hood, the weekend of June 21st through 23rd at King School Park in Portland. Good in the Hood is a multicultural music, art, and food festival celebrating diversity and connecting people with resources and experience to strengthen the unity in the community.
The Good in the Hood parade will take place Saturday starting at North Williams and North Russell Street at 11 a.m. and KBOO will be broadcasting the festival live on Saturday starting at 2 p.m. and Sunday starting at noon. Again, that's